Okay, we left off with a couple public policy questions. Collaboration, competition. Your lab's scientific agenda. Given the limited resources of your lab, in every lab, what are the and the constraints sometimes attached to those resources? What's the criteria that you use to determine what projects you work on and what projects you don't?
Yeah, I mean, I think that these criteria, so these criteria have sort of changed in my mind over the last few years. So when I first came here, there was a period where sort of in hindsight and also sort of by design, we played around a bit with different things, and then, you know, started a few projects and that then took on a life on their own. Now I'm much more, I've sort of become more disciplined, and I've sort of figured out that, and that is actually something that I didn't probably should have learned, would have learned if I had done a more proper postdoc in a sort of proper biology lab, that it really takes a lot of time and effort to learn something about, you know, to address an important question, and it takes focus. And so sort of recently tried to terminate certain projects and to focus really on a core area of biology, so that we can, you know, sort of look at the same thing from a different number of different standpoints, to really understand the biology a little bit more deeply. And so that has become an important consideration. In addition to, you know, does it fit into this focus that I see the lab should have, intellectual focus in terms of neurobiology? But then, of course, the other things always were true. Is it exciting? Is it new? Is it significant? And then do we see sort of, can we see through the end, in at least conceptually, and do we think we'll be able to overcome most of the problems?
Mm-hmm. Question about the nation's scientific agenda. As a nation, at least academic science is mostly overseen by the NIH, as you know. The NIH is not entirely immune from political pressures. We know PAC groups, celebrities, rabbis, any number of forces sort of can affect their decision, especially on controversial issues like stem cell and human cloning and the rest of it. If there were an imaginary commission, let's say, that were set up to oversee or to sign off on projects, controversial projects, and maybe uncontroversial, but in any case, on important research, who do you believe generically should be on that commission? Who should mostly make it up?
Well, I mean, it obviously I would think that it should be dominated by scientists.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who are... And that has traditionally been the case, of course, but there should be the religious leaders, ethicists, and so on should be, of course, represented, because there are, I think, I would call this a matter of public relations more than anything else. I don't, on these matters, I think that ethicists certainly have things to teach us, and cloning and so on, there are very, very significant ethical issues involved. I think that religious leaders, as sort of ethicists, also have things to teach us.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, in the end, I think these are scientific decisions, and these sort of decisions should be dominated by scientists. And I think scientists are well enough aware of where sort of I've yet to meet someone. There's just very little controversy about what should be done and shouldn't be done with stem cells, for example.
Right.
And it seems to me utterly uncontroversial what should be done and shouldn't be done. Yet, you know, it is an important debate that needs to be, you know, that needs to be fostered with the help of people who think about different things, including religion, and so for that reason, I think it should include religious leaders and ethicists and anyone else I've forgotten who should be on there.
Interestingly, I was at the Pew annual meeting in San Juan in this last March, and they had a speaker from whose research was partly funded by the Pew, and she was connected with the Science and Society Project.
Mm-hmm.
And her talk was about the public image that scientists have, and part of the resistance, it seems, among the public at large and, to stem cell research and other types of research, in her view, was the public perception of scientists being seen as amoral, if not immoral at times, mm-hmm. but amoral at least.
Mm-hmm.
And she had actually done interviews, face-to-face interviews with a sample of people and from across the country. And it was absolutely shocking with some of the things that she'd come up with. And of course, she's talking before a whole lot of scientists, mm-hmm. and they're being painted by
yeah.
the people that she interviewed as sometimes
right.
as monsters. As
you're right.
You know, not all, but
right.
certainly there were people who
right.
felt that scientists would almost do anything
mm-hmm.
in order to make a finding,
mm-hmm.
to be published,
mm-hmm.
to be famous.
And these are really interesting.
Yeah.
I see sort of the...
To get ahead. There were all manner of reasons. They were almost all negative.
I see.
But it was an incredible talk, if indeed, you know, the research...
That's interesting. Yeah, I is this somewhere published?
Well, it's Kathy Hudson's work, so
I have
yeah,
to contact her. Maybe I'll
she does
there.
Have a website.
Kathy Hudson, H-U,
yeah.
like the river.
Right, and I could give you the title of her talk as well, because they have that.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, of course, education and outreach, right, is something that we're terrible at, right. This place is actually very relatively, it's a real pioneer in this. I don't know if you knew that, but we have a very, very strong and rich relationship with neighbors. And some of them are quite surprising. You know, I mean, of course, lots of wealthy people around, but very supportive of what's going on. And then they run this place called the DNA Learning Center, which
mm-hmm.
is really an extraordinary place where they bus in tons of students, you know, who learn about PCR, about sort of forensics and that kind of stuff, but also adults who can take essentially primer in molecular biology, do experiments, learn about what is involved. There are lectures of all kinds in the genetics of mental disease and all sorts of controversial topics,
mm-hmm.
right? SNP sequencing, the human genome sequence, all this kind of stuff that is very, very well attended and integrated into the community. It's a DNA Learning Center. It's actually in Cold Spring Harbor. It's a converted school. It's year-round, full-time DNA science education center. But no, I mean, there's clearly we do things wrong, right? I mean, because on that front, there's no question. But I mean, the thing is, what I find more equally shocking is that just no one knows anything about science.
Exactly.
Really. And that what you just described is really a very sophisticated Machiavellian view of scientists, which
yes.
was just sort of something I hadn't encountered. So
mm-hmm.
people who usually know about it are quite sympathetic in my experience, or at least express themselves sympathetically to me.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's it too. I think it depends too on where you are in the country. It depends, I think, on class. It depends on a lot of different determinants. And
yeah.
she goes through some of these as
yeah.
well when she gave her talk.
This is actually very interesting. Yeah,
this
obviously deserves study, and I've never.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was about the public image, and one of the questions I had was, does your institute? I mean, the question of. Science literacy in America and people's image of science. And I was wondering, does your own institution, obviously, to some respect it does, is it concerned with this? And then
yeah,
invite you? Does it invite, does it request other scientists to attend town hall meetings or suggest that they do so? Or is that completely voluntary?
No, this place is very effective that way. And I mean, good, and some of it, you know, some self-serving, you know. I mean, right. and obviously they, you know, they make a big deal about cloning a breast cancer gene, you know, in ways that is perhaps I would see as almost inappropriate, you know, the link to cure, right, and that kind of stuff. But but in general, I think it's this place. I've been very impressed with how that has been done, the outreach and interaction with the community. I mean, this is really a very, very effective place. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if the impact and sort of public understanding of science from Cold Spring Harbor is larger than most major research research universities.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it's through the DNA Learning Center, it's through public lectures, but it's also through some other stuff. So, for example, some of us have gone to give talks in before or after. There's this actually fantastic cinema in Huntington, like a repertory cinema.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of also sort of a not-for-profit institution. It's been a cinema art center, it's called. And when they show movies about science, they often invite, there's some arrangement, I actually don't know who does it on this end, they actually arrange for someone to give a talk about the topic there, which is kind of fun, you know. So, you know, there's about Gattaca, right, about cloning, and, you know, there's, I don't remember what it's called, there are couple of films recently about amnesia, about memory, and so on, and so that's another way to have exposure. Now, granted, this is a very educated sort of public there that right. goes to these things, but it's probably very sympathetic, anyways. But anyways, I'm very curious to hear about this. So, and I think we could be doing more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I mean, science shouldn't be viewed that way, I think. You know, I mean, of course, many of the things that that person expressed, or the interviewee through Hudson's, through your
right.
interpretation, but are right. You know, we are like any other people. We want to get ahead. We were ambitious. But I think there are clear limits, and there's a very important role for science. And
right.
I think if people understood science and the role science plays, and the how little resources it actually swallows, right? I think there would be no question. I think that it's worthwhile.
Right. Part of that public image is created by the media. Do you believe that the media overall, things like the New York Times, New Yorker, I don't know, other avenues, websites, do you think that the media presents science fairly in a balanced way?
Well, it's rarely, you know, it's a good question. You know, I think that I've read actually pretty good descriptions about the doing of science,
mm-hmm.
right? Sort of, so the New Yorker has had a few stories, you know, for example, about the human adult stem cells in the cortex, right? And I don't know if you read that.
No, I didn't.
This was a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
But the sort of the controversies and who the players are and so on and so forth. But even sophisticated publications have a hard time with describing science, with really pointing out the important issues and why something is important. And it's really, I find it's best when they essentially just quote scientists. Now, this is my particular perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm obviously fairly sophisticated compared to even the average New York Times reader, and may just not be possible to do it justice. You know, I mean, we do press releases, and it's just this constant battle with the writer
mm-hmm.
here about, you know, how to cut corners and what to say and what not to say, and accuracy versus readability, right?
Right, right.
And
do you feel that they're sort of dumbing it down too much then, or popularizing it to the point of incomprehensibility?
Perhaps, right. Yeah. But it might, you know, I know the public less than I perhaps should. You know, my wife, for example, is very, you know, I can, be, you know, we talk about these things and she really understands. I mean, she's, you know, she, it could be more sophisticated for her. It
right.
could be more sophisticated for my father,
mm-hmm.
you know, so. Mm. You know, I think the scientific American of 10, 15, 20 years ago, it would be, is a great model. You know, there was actually good people wrote good articles that could serve both as introductory material for an undergraduate biology course, but were also sufficiently well written and illustrated to be, you know, to be digestible by people who buy that stuff at an airport kiosk.
Right.
You know. And I don't really think, I think that's really gone downhill, Scientific American, and like no one would use an article from Scientific American in a course.
Right.
No. And nothing has filled the niche.
Right. Why do you think that there has been that decline?
I don't know. Yeah. I really don't know. I don't know the economics. I browse through it. Recently, I looked through lots of issues. They've asked me to write an article for Scientific American, and I was sitting on the fence for so long because of that issue, because
right.
I thought it was not worthwhile, that in the end, the editor who asked me left and pursued another career, so that was that.
Final question, at least in public policy, about privatization, about the relationship between industry science and academic science. Some people have pointed up that this relationship has become more and more complicated, and that the sort of interconnections are blurring maybe the division between the two, a division that some people feel should be maintained, especially in terms of academic science and free inquiry and other things. What is your own view of that relationship?
I'm actually fairly naive on that front. Okay, so we've been funded by private foundations, so there's never been any trouble, and we have on occasion consulted, with companies, but I don't think that's ever had any effect on what we're doing in the laboratory. And there are clearly important bounds that need to be maintained, right? In particular, with respect to clinical science. But on the other hand, I think a close collaboration between private industry and academic science can be incredibly fruitful,
mm-hmm.
right? Especially when you talk about bringing something to the clinic. That's not something we're in the business of doing, right? And so it might be very natural to collaborate or to become essentially the research arm of a company that works on a drug to solve a biomedical problem that actually exists at Cold Spring Harbor, where people are fairly project oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Where, of course, the company funds a lot of that research.
Right.
And students can still get an excellent education, they can still publish, they can write a thesis, and so on. You know, quality control, I think, is independent of that. But obviously, it has to be open and has to be revealed, right? And with clinical stuff, there are a whole bunch of other issues that come into it.
There that are, they can get sticky sometimes.
Yeah, that I'm not as familiar with, but they seem obvious, right? I mean, you...
Mm-hmm. All right, final questions. You said your lab is about more or less 15 people?
Yeah.
Okay, and what is the breakdown between men and women?
It's about, let's see, I've got, let's see. There's four women.
Okay.
Five women in the lab, about a third. Yeah.
And what is that breakdown, let's say, on the departmental level among PIs? How big is your department?
Well, we don't have departments, but it's a little bit tricky. Okay, I think that probably the fraction of women is probably on a third on average.
Okay.
In my, I work on a very sort of, biophysics-y field. So I think I'm proud of the women in my lab. Mm-hmm. I think it's more than average.
Right.
And there are relatively few women in imaging. So we have often, when there is a symposium, it's often a problem to find female contributors.
Really? And why do you think that is?
Well, it's the kind of area of science that it's people who come from physics typically do well. There are relatively few women in physics graduate education, right? And it may have to do with we built our own instruments, and women are less comfortable doing that. They have not had the same kind of experiences in, still not, right? I mean, it's, and who knows why that is, I won't go there, but clearly very few women have fixed motorcycles and, read popular mechanics and worked with toy, built toy planes and these kinds of things, which are sort of, for many tinkerers in the lab, a sort of part of a common experience.
Right.
And it is really, but it's possible to overcome that, I think. And people have, and women have in my lab, but also men, of course, right? So it's sort of the science is more amenable to the typical experience that boys tend to have than girls tend to have.
Right.
That's sort of my explanation.
Mm-hmm. And how about where do these people come from nationally? What countries are they coming from in your lab?
Let's see. Netherlands, France, Italy, Japan, Norway, Argentina, Russia, Germany, Poland, China.
That's a broad overview.
Yeah, there's a couple Americans.
Right.
Yeah, but it's a fairly broad spectrum. In addition, we've had Hungarian in the lab, and maybe one or two other countries. That's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. A couple more questions about gender. Do you believe that the playing field is level between men and women PIs who are doing science in the field?
Well, I don't think it is. I mean, there's no question about that. I mean, mm-hmm. I think I see that. I see that. Yeah, I mean, women are different than men in some instances and in some sort of sense. And I think that the differences are really not. Women clearly are at a disadvantage, and I think that the question really is, how do you fix that? And the disadvantage is especially acute, women drop out most, which is sort of at the end of grad school, first postdoc,
right,
where people really have to make that decision about family, and
women always carry more of a burden there. And probably will always carry more of a burden there. I mean, it's very, very unusual where the man carries more of a burden. You know, we have perhaps one instance, we have friends where that's the case. And there are feelings of guilt that come with that, you know, and so there are these couple years where these kids are very important, where you just can't get as much done, where perhaps you should have, that should be recognized differently, I don't know. But I think that's really, there the playing field is really uneven. And I think that's probably the main reason, in my opinion, why women leave science. That's a very challenging thing to deal with.
Right. Yeah. How about actually doing science? Do you see that men and women approach science differently? Do they think differently, conceive of it differently? Do they shine at different parts of the scientific endeavor?
No, I don't see that. I mean, I think that I've had, of course, more men in the laboratory, so some things that men have done, women haven't done, and it's less so vice versa. But I think that the women I've had in the lab have really done a diverse set of things and have approached things in different ways. Some, you know, were, you know, a couple of them really learned real sort of things that are, so, you know, typically more male, you know, sort of have built microscopes and programmed computers and stuff, and learned that actually pretty late. I mean, not considering their in their late 20s when they come here, or for postdocs, right? And others, yeah, it's been fairly mixed, I feel.
Mm-hmm. What is the best part about having the job that you have? What's the best part about being a PI?
Well, I think the best part of it is that it involves a huge number of diverse responsibilities that I think interesting and involve, of course, the doing of science, which we are fairly, you know, which is rewarding. You get to work with very lots of interesting people, the people in the laboratory who are very smart and developing at a rapid pace. So that's a very rewarding things to witness. But then also the science, the data coming forth, the sort of understanding of biological phenomena that come about, discoveries, all of that stuff really makes it exciting. I mean, it really is, I feel it's a job where, you know, I really look forward going to work. I mean, that's sort of the gold standard. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's we're very fortunate to be in a situation like that. And it's not universal, right? I mean, most people count the hours to the weekend and so on. So it's a very, very good situation to be in. And we can, it's really, we have relative freedom. You know, we're working on projects that we define, I think, within bounds, with a long-term vision and a, you know, long and short-term plans. And it's just, we really control our, I think, destinies more than most people.
Mm-hmm. What were the consequences on you and your lab at the Pew Grant?
Well, I mean, for me, this was really quite significant because it was sort of the first thing that came into the lab. But that and the Klingenstein, which is similar in some ways. And it, you know, it really is a great honor. I mean, I'm not just, you know, the very, very good people have gotten the Pew. So you look back and you see, oh, look at this, you're part of this group. And then you, so that's the first thing, it gives you a huge amount of confidence. And then the money is actually more important than one would think, because it's essentially doesn't have strings attached, so you can bank it. And you know, we've bought big pieces of equipment from it that are just difficult to get. You know, it's mm-hmm. not something you write a grant for easily, especially if you're beginning lab.
Right.
Of course, I could have burnt more, of course, from harvest money, probably. And then there are these meetings, and I've actually met a fair number of people there at the Pew meeting that I talk to fairly frequently, collaborate with, mm-hmm. You know, a research program that is fairly, you know, it's quite vigorous in the lab, was really initiated there. And actually, did you actually interview Greg Hannon?
I'm sorry?
Greg Hannon, did you interview him?
No, I think it was someone else.
Yeah.
Well, we have his interview done. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he is a colleague of mine here. I mean, his entire research program was initiated there, essentially.
Oh, yeah.
So it was really scientifically quite rich.
And the final question, which is, I'll give the mic entirely to you, and is there anything that you want to clarify, anything you want to add to the record that we haven't covered?
Right. I think not now. I'll look at the transcript and do it at that point.
Okay.
I don't remember what I said, so yeah.
All right. Well, I want to thank you for letting me.
Great. Well, thanks. It was fun, yeah. It really gets to sort of...